Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And welcome to a new episode of the Geektown Behind the Scenes podcast. I'm your host, Dave Elliott, and on this episode, I'm chatting with multiple members of the cast and crew of the new British sci-fi show Intergalactic, which premieres Friday the 30th of April on Sky One and streaming service Now. Written by the award-winning showrunner Julie Geary, who you'll know from things like Prisoner's Wives, Cuffs, and Secret Diary of a Call Girl, Intergalactic tells the story of a young cop and galactic pilot, Ash Harper, who has her glittering career ripped out from under her when she is wrongly convicted of a treasonous crime. Ash is sentenced to exile on a prison planet and loaded onto the prison spaceship, the Hemlock, for transfer. But she never actually reaches her destination, as there is a mutiny aboard the ship staged by her fellow inmates. With the flight crew dead, mob leader Tula Clerk is intent on reaching the free world of Arcadia with her gang. And Ash, reluctantly, is the only pilot left on board to fly the ship. As the gang go on the run across the galaxy, they will travel to many different planets, make friends and encounter dangerous enemies, all the time with the authorities on their tail. As the journey continues, Ash begins to reevaluate her dangerous cohorts. Could it be that this group of female fugitives are on the wrong side of the law, but the right side of history? We were shown the opening three episodes of the series for these interviews. There are some very mild spoilers in here, but if you're the type of person that doesn't want to know anything going into the show, then obviously watch the first few episodes and then come back and listen to this. There's nothing too big that would spoil anything for you, though. I have to say, I loved what I saw. I really, really enjoyed those opening three episodes. If you're old enough to remember the classic show Blake 7, that was definitely a touchstone for this series, and it's wonderful to see them create a new, brilliant British spacefaring sci-fi show. The interviews took place during a virtual press junket, so they split the cast and crew up into three separate groups, so you'll hear me and some other press people as well asking questions throughout. The first group features the relative newcomer Savannah Stein, who plays the lead, Ash Harper, Perminder Nagra, who you will know from a million different shows such as ER, 13 Reasons Why, Fortitude, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., a ton of other stuff as well. She plays Ash's mother, Rebecca, who also happens to be the head of galactic security for the Commonwealth as well. And Craig Parkinson, who has been in a load of different things. The English Game, Temple, Misfits, and of course Line of Duty is probably where a lot of people were known for. He plays Dr. Benedict Lee, who is the leader of the Commonwealth government. He's also a brilliant and seemingly somewhat shady scientist as well. Here's the first set of interviews. This is Savannah Stein, Perminder Nagra, and Craig Parkinson. It's lovely chatting with you all, and thank you for doing this talk. I've seen the first three episodes of the show and absolutely love it. It's very much my genre. So, Perminder, I think start with you. How is it getting into the show? Because you've got some sort of form doing sci-fi and that sort of show before. So how was it coming to a British sci-fi like this? It's a very rare thing these days.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'd worked with Kieran Hawkes, our director, before on Fortitude. So as soon as I was told that he was involved in this project, to be honest with you, it was first and foremost, I was excited because he was directing it. And I just sort of was like, okay, I can feel this is going to be good. And then, of course, I read it and I just loved the character. I loved that there was really something for me to get my teeth into. And then the world that we were creating, honestly, Dave, to be honest with you, I didn't even quite realize until I was saying this before with Craig, until you watched the trailer back, it then just takes on a whole other epic turn, because, you know, you're sort of seeing some of the you know, special effects, you know, the silver balls that arrive on set, and the, you know, the rooms that we're in, that are, our set decoration was just like, we were in awe, like walking into those spaces. So to me, it was just A, fun coming back, B, fun working with a director I've worked with before. And I got to make, you know, new friends and got to sort of hang out in England for a little bit. So it was all of that and more.
Awesome. And Craig, what about you? This is, I mean, you did Misfits, so you've done sort of sci-fi and superhero adjacent stuff.
How, yeah,
getting involved with a pure, full-blown sci-fi thing.
Yeah, I mean, completely different ballpark. Again, I'm going to have to take Palmender's lead. I, too, have been lucky enough to work with Kieran Hawkes in the past. And I was filming the Netflix show The English Game, which is a big period piece,
yeah,
again, in the north of England. But I had a big Hughes beard, very, very long hair. And then the prospect of thrusting myself far, far into the future and being all just completely de-shedding the skin of that character and jumping into something that I hadn't really... I mean, of course, I dipped my toe in a little bit in the genre-bending stuff with Misfits, but this is quite full on. And yeah, it's set in the future, but I don't think we need to just put it firmly in the science fiction category. I think it's so much more than that, and so exciting that it's a female led ensemble on UK telly, and it's, I think the timing is right. But yeah, it was a real pull for me at first seeing Kieran's name attached, because you know you're in a very safe pair of hands who cares about his work so much. You go, oh great, we're on the same level because we have such passion for what we do. And I know he's going to get together a great cast and crew that are all on the same page. So that's one thing you don't need to worry about. But I just thought, well, this is going to be a real exciting ride. And I remember Palmender was just talking about the set pieces before and the structure. I remember when we went into Dr. Lee's lab for the first time.
Oh, God.
Shot us.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, but disconcerting, because it was all mirrored floors and we had to wear cover, what are they called? Shoe cut.
Booties. Shoe
right.
Little booties, because you couldn't mess it up because it was just gleaming. But you look down and you're in a mirror and it was a bit woozy effect. I started to feel a bit sick at one point. And then we have to sort of, you know, get the silver balls in for the special effects, and there's going to be, this is what's going to happen now. There's going to be all these bees around here. So you're just constantly trying to imagine what it's going to be like. And I'm sure even in your own head, you've got quite a clear vision. It ain't going to be that. It's going to be something much more spectacular. But it was a real joy, wasn't it? I mean, it was just so exciting because everybody was doing lots of things that they hadn't done before and breaking down some barriers, both in sort of storyline terms and in the set pieces. Hopefully this is going to work. And yeah, it was an education.
Yeah.
Lucas, do you have a question?
Sure, yeah. I'd like to ask Savannah, first of all, happy birthday. I mean, this is really your first big lead role and you're taking charge of this huge ensemble cast. How did that feel? What were the challenges of that?
It was wild. I didn't think it was going to happen. Like, I remember auditioning for it and just feeling like, you know, it's never going to happen. Do you know what I mean? It's just never gonna happen. I've only done like very tiny roles on telly before, so I wasn't expecting it. And it was a dream. It was very challenging just because I feel like as a new actor, like, I'm not like, just feel like you don't know what you're doing. I just felt like I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't even know how to lead a show, let alone like lead my own scene. I don't know what I'm doing. But I think it was so great having people like Craig, Parminder, Eleanor, Sharon, but having such seasoned actors that I've been watching from I was a kid, like sitting opposite from them, and seeing like their freedom and the way that they embody their characters and what they bring every day. It was that I found really useful, taking guidance from all of them, from Kieran, from everyone was really helpful and supportive. So I think that's what kind of got us through to the end.
Sarah, do you have a question?
I see Sarah's taking it very professionally because she's out having a bloody picnic in the park.
Yeah, where is she?
I'm not in England.
Whereas we're all inside.
She needs to get her son.
Yeah, Sarah, what's going on? Where are you?
I've got a bloody wardrobe to move and you're outside having a picnic, Sarah.
Great, you could have made an effort, Craig.
Honestly.
Craig, not even. I'm literally inside. They've just got this fancy plant set up inside. So it looks like I'm outside.
I mean, I'll believe you, thousands of wouldn't, but yeah.
I've seen it. So my first question is for Savannah. I mean, you, like, right in the very first scene, you sort of hit the ground, like, literally and figuratively running. Right. And so can you talk about some of the action scenes that you have and what they were like to film?
Yeah, I loved shooting the action scenes. I've always wanted to do action. Ash is always running, which is funny, because when I saw the poster came out yesterday for what they'll use on socials and everything in it, it's literally Ash running. There was a lot of running. And I run every day of my actual life, so that was fun. And I remember, like, a couple of weeks before, they brought me to Manchester where we shot, and Kieran, who is actually a trained kickboxer, trained me. Like, we just did some fights. And he's the most loving, warm guy, but he's also low-key. Yeah. He's also low-key. Like, he has, like, very Viking vibe. No. Soft Viking vibe. And so
he'll take that.
Yeah, Viking's good.
Yeah.
Rugged. We
shot anything yet. And I didn't know him all that well, but it was so great having that time to bond with him and also, like, learn to fight. And he's fierce as well. So I feel like that was a great, like, lead into shooting the action stuff, which was a lot of fun.
I didn't know he took you off training. That's great.
He did. It was the big rooms on set, like before they built some of the set. I was there a couple of weeks before and we were just training, the two of us with Max, his assistant.
That's amazing. And what fun.
It was.
He's the Swiss Army knife of directors. He kind of does a bit of everything, really, doesn't he?
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Look at him.
Yeah.
Did he teach any cool moves, like a special pinch that, like, makes someone freeze or something?
I'm sure she'll show you some now. Yeah. Savannah, can you just get
can
up
you and please demonstrate?
Demonstrate. I need to see this. I think that was probably aimed at me. Thank you.
He taught me loads of stuff, like kicks and punches, but we shot this all a year ago, so I can't really remember now. Me and my personal life, I'm not a fighter, so I can't too tough remember. But Ash knows what she's doing.
She certainly does.
David Bell, do you have a question?
Yeah, sure. Hi guys. One of the things I love about this is that tonally there's lots of things going on. There's a lot of depth to it. There's also a rich theme of very black humour running through it. There's that great scene where the poor security guard is listening to Phil Collins. I think that's in episode 3. Was that important to you that you know it had shifting moods and shifting tones?
I think so. It was. It's like I was saying to Dave before, to put it purely in a science fiction category is kind of doing it a disservice, because it's got so much, and a lot of that dark humour really sort of sings to me with any script. But to see it in this context is so appealing. And I suppose it's the excitement right from the word go, right from episode 1, and you just thrust into this world and you're on this chase. You've got to play catch up as an audience member. And I think more and more now, certainly, and I always go back to The Sopranos, how I feel that The Sopranos changed television all those years ago, not just with budgets, but with its casting. And you're seeing people who they're not on the treadmill of television all the time. And I think that's what Intergalactic does, and does it very well. It doesn't spoon feed the audience. It kind of, you know, yes, it grabs them by the collar and says, we're going to go for a massive ride, but it makes them work for the story a bit.
It's so entertaining and so thrilling, but there's so much that's so relatable on so many different levels. You know, yes, we have the dark humor and we have grief, we have pain. It's like there's so much going on that is relevant also to present day life and people. It gives you a little bit of everything. And I think that's what was so fun to watch and play, and helmed by, you know, the people that have, you know, Julie Geary. It's a testament to how she writes and puts all of those, even sometimes just within one scene or one sentence, you know, you could just go through a journey. So really starts from those guys. And then
and also I think we were really lucky, of course, to have Kieran directing quite the main bulk, but when it was passed to China Moon Young, she really put her stamp on it. But kept that same yeah. tone that was set as a template, and she just slotted so easy into this world that we'd spent all that time creating, certainly what Julie had spent much longer creating. Yeah. It was a seamless transition.
We've just got 2 minutes, but Lucas, do you want to ask a question? I think I interrupted you earlier.
I thought the series had a lot of sort of real world edge to it. It fit quite nicely with sort of changing attitudes towards the police currently. I was wondering if you guys could just quickly touch on where your characters sort of fit in with that. Obviously, Parminda, you're playing Rebecca, who's sort of at the head of all this.
Oh, wow.
She's not at the head of it. Let's just
I'm actually not at the head of it. Actually, yes, I'm trying to do what the world that we've set up, she's trying to live within the parameters of that world. And she believes that her cause is correct and right and will fight for it. And she feels that, she feels strongly enough about it that, you know, she will do what she has to do. In terms of the real world stuff, you say, I don't want to go off too much on that because I don't know, that's like more than 2 minutes, right? I'm going to get so political. All I know is my corner of my Commonwealth office and what she feels about that, which is just she's very, very, very passionate about, you know, her station in life. So take what you will from that, I guess.
And I'm sick of talking about the police. The police always come back to haunt me in every press junket.
Right, yeah, it's true.
Sarah Dean, do you have a final question?
Actually, Craig, my impression when viewers see the first episode, to me, Benedict's motives aren't quite clear yet, obviously, but I just wanted to get in your description of the character in your words, and also because obviously you've played a villain in like quite an indie cop show recently, and also you've played like good people in, say, Indian Summers, for example. Do you have a preference as to whether you play someone who's slightly shady, or do you like playing heroes? Are you drawn to one more than the other?
Yeah, it's not that cut and dry, Sarah, I think. I mean, I'm really, you know, everything, and I know how to say this, it all harks back to the script. And if it's something that's rich and layered and interesting, and I feel that I could do a really good job with. And also, I mean, I must admit, I was slightly terrified of taking on this role because it is so complex. I remember sitting down with Kieran and having lunch with him, and we were discussing about where he thought the character should be going and what my initial thoughts were. And we both came to the same conclusion that it was, the character was almost Lynchian in the way he holds himself, and he's quite asexual in a way, and his physicality is something that I was interested in sort of developing and going a little deeper with that, because he's got such a fantastic mind, but he's quite clinical. You know, you never see him physically interact with anybody. He seems to be wanting complete control over everything. And that was just something slightly scary. And I think it's always good to be quite scared. And because if you go into something that's completely fully formed, you've got nowhere to go as an actor. So I just wanted to go on there. Obviously, I do my homework, but it morphs when you get on the floor, certainly when you're working with someone like Parminda and someone like Kieran for most, I mean, not really Parminda. That
not much, really me.
Maybe Kieran. But you just want to sort of develop it and have that space.
The next set of interviews features Sharon Duncan Brewster, who you'll know from Rogue One. She was in Sex Education, June. She's been in a load of other things as well. She plays Tula, a dangerous and volatile female gangster who is on board the ship and is the instigator, really, in taking control of it as well. Newcomer Dini Sanba Banza stars in her television debut as Genevieve, Tula's daughter, who has undergone some interesting weaponized body modification, shall we say. And Thomas Turngoose, who I'm sure people will know from This Is England, who plays Drew, a prison guard who is the only member of the crew not killed during the mutiny, and has started to develop a thing for Genevieve as well. So here's the interview with Sharon, Dini and Thomas.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
First question to Sharon. You've got a really interesting character on the show. She's very tough. She's trying to be in control of everything, but that seems to be slipping away from her. Do you just want to talk a little bit about getting into that character?
You sound like you're being polite there. You're being a control freak. She's to get into that character, to get into the character of Tula, who is obnoxious. She's rude in every sense of the word. She's controlling. She's selfish. She's a narcissist. She's a psychopath. How does one get into that character? I did a bit of research and I channeled every rude part of my quiet, lovely, gentle self and went, get rid of that and just do everything you've ever wanted to do to be rude to someone in your life. And I did watch a lot of sort of gang related Craig like documentaries and some old footage of different gang leaders and stuff like that, and read I didn't read any books because I'm not very good with books, but I sort of read different accounts online and stuff like that, and did a lot of psychological, just little bits and pieces to do with different psychologists talking about narcissists and psychopaths. But I make it sound like I did loads and loads and loads of work.
I was going to say, you're making it sound like I did nothing, Sharon. Come on. You're making us all look bad here, Jesus.
I didn't do as much as it sounds like I'm saying I did. I did some research though, and I just channeled my high octane self in with that knowledge.
Awesome. And Thomas, you're rather more the somewhat comic relief, I guess, on the show at the moment. Certainly in the opening three episodes, and you're also, it's a majority female cast. You're one of the few male characters on it. How is it working in that role on the show?
I mean, it's great fun, and like you just said, I'm one of very few male cast. It's such a breath of fresh air to see, you know, the ladies take control of the situations, and particularly Sharon, like she just said, you know, she's very much in control of Drew and there's nothing he can do about that. But yeah, you know, it was a breath of fresh air, and it was so nice to see something so different, you know, because you've seen all the shows where the men are in charge and it's all very sort of male led, whereas this was such a beautiful breath of fresh air to see the tables completely turned. In a sense, with the sort of the comic relief, I guess it's kind of like, as an audience member, you feel so sorry for Drew in a way. And we was just saying earlier on that it's almost so, you feel so sorry for him for the fact that he's scared to fall in love. He's scared to fall for someone. And it's sort of, it's very, very sad in a sense. But as the season progresses, he learns a lot about himself, and he learns a lot about Genevieve and Tula, and also, you know, the rest of the people on the ship. So yeah, it was a real, and I mean, when Oliver Cooper Smith came in, play Echo, I mean, he took the baton there. I mean, and he ran with it. He did a great job. He was so funny and so quick. Just sort of let me find my feet in other ways, I guess.
Hi guys, Sharon and Dani, I really loved your sort of unconventional family dynamic, shall we say. How was that playing off each other on set?
That was really fun. I think even because we auditioned together, I think from the get-go, I felt like a lot of good kind of like energy, like to bounce off of from you straight away. So even when we were on set, it was like, there was sometimes like a lot of unspoken messages where we just talking with our eyes, like, you know what I mean? And I think, yeah, you're just really easy to work with and like good to learn from as well.
I think it definitely helped that we connected. I mean, since the audition, when we auditioned together, I was there going, well, I really hope that this young talented actress gets it. She blew me away in the audition. And then when I found out that I had got it, I was like, I hope it was the same actress that I auditioned with. And then to take ourselves and then go through this really complex relationship, which is on the surface, you just think, okay, well, oh my gosh, that's her daughter, first of all. And then you find out what Tula has done in order to survive on a general day-to-day in the Commonwealth, and then how she is very manipulative with her daughter. She's very controlling in a sense of not only just in a mother-daughter relationship, but just as a sort of new age ganglord. She takes things to the nth degree, and when you find out what she's done
to her daughter, people will start to look at Tula in a different light, I think. And then we start to unpick how different their relationship really is. It's not your average mother-daughter relationship at all. So I think it's really interesting that Julie's very cleverly placed that device there to just to unravel what it means to be related to somebody in this new world that we will see.
I think we definitely found ourselves, like, when they said cut, to be like, are you okay? Was that all right? Was that too much? Because there were moments where it got really intense.
Yeah.
Shake it off a little bit.
For sure. But it's a sort of a new way of looking at an age-old issue, which is aggression within the family dynamic.
Yeah, the toxic love.
Yeah.
I have to say, I thought Tula and Genevieve were sisters, like, the whole time. So I was like, I know you guys, like, mentioned sort of mother and daughter, but at the beginning I was like, oh, they're not sisters. So I'm not just saying that's true. I genuinely thought you guys
were sisters. That's either a compliment to Sharon.
Yeah.
Or not so much to
Genevieve. Yes, it was.
Just be very careful.
Okay, Deanny, I was wondered if you could talk a bit about your character's hair, because that was her power with that was quite cool. So can you just talk about what it was like to have to put those dreads on every day, and how to sort of act out, you know, choking people to death with your own hair, and what that was like for you?
Definitely a new experience. Putting on the wig every morning was quite easy. I mean, I didn't really have any input, but, like, it didn't take much time. And once we were on set, it was kind of like, if it was a scene where I was, like, choking someone, like choking Drew, for example, at the start, it was kind of like a few gestures with my face to kind of show that, to signal that my hair's about to strangle him. And then there are other times where you'd have some stuntmen rigged up to, like, fly across a room, and this kind of, like, I was kind of going off of them as well. It was really fun, to be honest. Like, to pretend like you've got, like, powers is, like, always really cool. Like, I've been doing it since I was a kid, so to actually do it for a job, it's pretty cool. No, yeah, it was really fun, and, like, seeing it the end product was, like, insane. It looked so much cooler than I thought it was going to be. It was just a lot of fun.
Just touching on that sort of effects work, was that your first experience of doing that sort of effects for a show?
Yeah, I've never done anything like that before. I've never even worked with, like, green screen. I've not done, like, all of that was really new to me. But it was cool to see the kind of VFX people at work, and, like, when they put random objects and just put, like, the green crosses on them, and you're like, yeah, that's just going to be, like, a whole person. And you're like, oh, okay,
amazing,
cool.
Isn't it? Well, they can turn a tiny little green cross into it's amazing. I learned so much on that, about what they can do with special effects. Mm-hmm. So interesting.
They were such an integral part of the process as well, because you sort of imagine, I always thought that it would be, it's us, we shoot, we film it all, and then they come in later and do their stuff. But most of the time it would be, you'd finish a take and they would come in with a silver ball and they'd
bringing in the balls.
Bringing the balls.
Yeah.
So they're with us the whole time, which is quite, I think it's much more exciting, because you then have input. You have somebody giving you, you know, clues about what something's going to look like. That was one thing that, you know, they made very clear to us, that we, if we wanted to, we could go to the art department and talk to them about what things are going to look like. They showed us mock-ups of things.
So interesting to learn, though, isn't it? Sorry, Sharon.
Go ahead, bub. Go ahead.
It's so interesting to learn, like, you know, Sharon, you've been doing it for a long time. I've been doing it for a long time. And even it's so amazing that you can still learn so much, having been involved in the industry for so long. And it's just like, I think it's really interesting that you could be in the industry for as long as you want, but there's always going to be something else that you are going to learn. You know, you're always learning. I guess that's what makes our job so exciting and interesting, and no 2 days are the same, you know.
Plus, on top of this as well, I would agree with you, babe, is that the technology, the CGI, is cutting edge. It's not the technology that was 5 years ago, even 2 years ago. They're just pushing and pushing. So that we're always going to be learning each time we do that sort of, like you say, we always learn anyway. But yeah, that's the other thing that I'm hoping it's going to really please the audience, is how great the effects look, because I was really surprised when I saw the opening scene. I was like, wow, look at London time. Wow,
that's amazing. Yeah.
So it's going to be...
Maybe that's what Carnaby Street's like now. Nobody knows. Nobody
knows. I was going to ask, Thomas, I think we've all seen just the first three episodes and you're kind of Tula's punching bag for a lot of it. I think the moment when she threatens you over the intercom, I remember, was particularly great. How does that dynamic sort of change?
Very briefly touched on there, it's kind of like you feel so sorry for Drew because he meets a girl in the most unlikely circumstances. And it's so beautiful to see the way that their relationship goes from strength to strength throughout the series when it really shouldn't. And also, you know, it's kind of, when you think about it, you know, he's so terrified of Tula, but his feelings for Genevieve overcome that throughout the series. You know, it's kind of like he gets to the point where he goes, you know what, like I may love your daughter and you need to get used to that idea, you know. But I think as Tula to take that on board, because Genevieve's not only Tula's daughter, she's also her protection. So it's kind of like he's not only taken away her daughter, taken away what she needs in a way. So yeah, it's kind of, it's nice to see that Drew sort of stands up to him for himself, you know, as the season progresses and, you know, without ruining too much. And it was so great to delve into that with Sharon and Dainey. So yeah, I'm just sort of excited as myself as a fan of the show to see how that looks on screen and how the audience may feel.
Aaron, do you see Tula warming to Drew at all?
I think she may, but maybe she might get to the point where she feels like she needs Drew. And there's a point where, and I'm not giving no spoilers away here, but you know, she kind of like, yeah, maybe she might think, well, actually, I can use Drew here.
I was just thinking as you were talking, Tomo, that as you said, Dainey plays a character that is utilized in so many different ways. But for Tula, I would say she's a source of protection as well, as you said, yeah. And for you to extract that element, that just changes everything. And so I do wonder, because Tula's got so many different tactics, ways of coping. She's normally quick on her feet. And she's manipulative. And just when you think she's going to attack with aggression, there are times when she goes a totally different way, a route. So I wonder, especially with Drew, where we'd go from this, where we go next.
Yeah.
And is it about aggression or is it something a lot more manipulative?
But also it's just trying to find, you know, there's, I think Drew just desperately wants Tula to like him and to respect him. And
yeah,
I guess there's kind of no real way of earning that respect because he's taken the one thing that's important to her, you know. So it's kind of it's a very, very touchy relationship. But it'll be very interesting, you know, if we do get to go on and tell more of the story. It's the thing that I'm most excited about is seeing where Drew, Genevieve, and Tula, you know, find themselves.
Hey, my next question is for Dainey again. With the success of Bridgerton, there's been like a lot of talk about quote unquote colorblind casting. I just wondered, like, being part of this program, what your thoughts on that are. Do you think that was like a conscious decision in this program? And just, yeah, what your thoughts are generally on it?
I'm not sure like how they came to decide who they wanted to cast and for what reason. I'm glad they did though. I'm glad they included some black women in there and that they didn't just stop at kind of, here's just a black woman and a black woman, but gave them like, you know, central roles. And like, it's a hard kind of thing to talk about whether it's like what comes first. Do you like cast someone because they're black? Do you cast someone because they're talented or whatever? But I feel like sometimes there's not really a need to separate the two. And what they did well with this was that it didn't even cross my mind as to why they would have picked people of color as the role for the roles they did. I think it's just great that they did.
The last set of interviews features Imogen Daines, who you popped up in The Witcher and Black Mirror. She plays Verona, a reckless cyber hacker who we meet in the very first episode and revels in the delicious irony of the fact that she's now locked up alongside the cop who arrested her, i.e. Ash Harper. And also Oliver Cooper Smith, who was recently in Tin Star. He plays the space pirate Echo, who Ash meets in the second episode. He has the charm of Han Solo, the sort of swagger of Jack Sparrow. He's kind of the epitome of the lovable rogue. He's a wonderful, wonderful character. And also Iona Vrolik, who is exec producer on the series. So here's the interview with Imogen, Oliver, and Iona. Lovely to see you all. Oliver, your character comes in, it's episode two you arrive, isn't it? There's something of a sort of Han Solo-ness about him, I rather feel. How was it coming to that character, and were there influences of people like Han Solo and that sort of thing in there?
You know what? Yeah, it's right. He comes in episode two and he kind of saves the day, but comes to the rescue. And yeah, I've got to be honest, as soon as I read him on the page, there was similarities. Han Solo, I thought of Chris Pratt in Guardians of the Galaxy. There was sort of lots of different things that I could pick out. Spiller from The Borrowers was another person that I was like, oh, that's who it reminds me of. But I have to say, I did very little research for this, I have to say, because you turn up on set in the costume and the sets were incredible and detailed. The makeup was impeccable. The script was great. It was all there. So it was like, turn up on time, know your lines and be ready to sort of adapt and play. But I did look at Harrison Ford flying the Millennium Falcon because I was a bit nervous about making it seem believable flying a ship when actually all you've got in front of you is a lighting guy or a boom guy or whatever. And it seems that if you just press a lot of buttons and battle some thrust, you can sort of make it seem convincing. So that was got from Harrison Ford.
Imogen, you have a really interesting character as well, because she's sort of a prisoner, but not sort of as evil as maybe some of the others. The others are kind of really kind of hard and tough, and you're a bit more in the grey. So how is it balancing that as an actor?
It was one of the reasons I was really attracted to the part and actually the whole script, is I don't think that Julie has written goodies and baddies. She really has just written humans under intense stress. So it makes it so much easier, because every time there's what seems like an extreme decision, she's giving you the motivation for it. So while she is technically a criminal, she's stolen this new Aurum at the top of the show, she's done it out of sheer desperation because she's being kept down by a dictatorship and has been orphaned and has nobody to rely on. She's just fending for herself. So yeah, I think there's this whole spectrum of evil that we meet across the show. And yeah, Verona's, to my mind, 100% good, of course. But when she does cross a line or let someone down, I think, and I hope, if I've done her justice, the audience understands why she's done it every time, rather than just having someone who's behaving for no obvious reason, you know, completely terribly. That makes sense.
That's so interesting. Sorry to jump in, but that's, I think, what makes the scene in episode three with the prison guards. I love that scene. And Alex Carter, who plays the prison guard, I thought he was great and he plays it so well. But between the two of you, that scene, I don't know, it just really hits home. And I think that everything you've just explained is sort of, it feels like a massive moment for her, that scene.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Ol. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed doing that scene, because you just get an opportunity to humanise an act, basically. You're given that little bit more script and that little bit more space and time to sit with the repercussions of your actions, rather than just an action show in which you get people shooting and running around and everything's hunky-dory and you're essentially glorifying violence. This show, I don't think it ever does that. You always see how those scenes affect the characters.
My question is for Iona. I was really quite impressed with, like, the production, and we've already talked about the CGI and the effects with the other cast. So how, like, hands-on were you for that, like, and what were the biggest challenges of bringing such a huge sci-fi world to the screen?
I think our show had a really healthy budget, but I think the challenge with any world building show and science fiction show is how do you achieve it for the budget that you have. And particularly for this show, which is, it's a road movie through space, and so what's so exciting about the series, I think, is that every episode has its own aesthetic, it has its own sets, it has different planets that they visit. And so there was a massive challenge for the production in terms of realizing the huge ambition that was on the scripts. But the thing that all of the creatives bought into was that vision. And we just had the most amazing lead director in Kieran Hawkes. And we had the most amazing heads of department who were all wanted to make sure that the show was not let down in any way. So our set designer, Mark Geraghty, did an amazing job. And for me and our VFX team through Milk also did an amazing job. And it was the particular relationship led by Kieran with the set designer, a production designer, sorry, and the VFX team that really allowed us to create those incredible worlds. So I'm really glad that you've responded to that, because it was, you know, whenever you start a show, I always worry about what could go wrong. And obviously when you're creating so many worlds, it's how do you make sure that they all work and do them all justice, but also that the whole series has a coherence. And so it was sort of my job to facilitate very, very brilliant people to do their best work and to be incredibly creative and incredibly inventive, so that when these guys walked on sets, it was there and they understood what the episode was going to look like. So yeah, it was a big job, and it took the quickest and simplest answer to your question is prep. You know, what was amazing about having Kieran Hawkes as lead director and an executive producer on the show was that he prepped absolutely everything. So every single person on that floor knew what they were trying to set out to achieve. And I think that shows of this scale get into trouble when you don't have that level of preparation and when things start changing at the last minute. But we were very robust in locking down our scripts and making sure that there weren't last minute changes that could catch us out. And by having Kieran and Julie driving that clear vision creatively, it allowed all of our heads of department to follow suit. That was probably the biggest challenge, but also the thing that was the most rewarding and satisfying to get right.
My follow-up was going to be if you couldn't quite fit any ideas into the first series, but it sounds like it was a pretty efficient production and you got pretty much everything in that you wanted to.
Pretty much. I mean, there's always a process of consolidation and editing that happens. Certainly the big picture editorial didn't really change for us. There were certain sets that it just became prohibitive to have so many sets. So within episodes, we might consolidate action into one place. But that wasn't anything that you wouldn't have on a non-science fiction show, for example. That's a pretty standard thing with production, that as your director sits down with the location manager and the rest of the team, you start making sure that the scripts then become tailored for the set or the set that you're shooting in. We pretty much achieved what we set out to, which was gratifying.
My question is for Imogen and Oliver. It's a sci-fi program, which is quite high concept, set in a completely new world. But I just wondered if you could like narrow it down, sort of give us like the message that you hope people will take away from it when they watch it, other than all the brilliant sets and special effects and action. Like, what is this story about in both of your minds?
I really like that question, because it's so easy to end up talking about all the bells and whistles. And I think it's really important, because it's such a profoundly human drama, to focus on exactly what you're talking about. And to my mind, and particularly for my character, but I think for everyone, actually, I would say the message is that solidarity is rewarded. It's a show about eight people trying very hard to not depend on anybody else. And every week, every episode, every world that they enter, they discover bit by bit that it doesn't work to need no one. And so I'd say, yeah, solidarity is rewarded would be my takeaway message.
Nice. I think people will take away lots of different messages. And I think, you know, you got to watch it to figure out, you know, how it sits with you and how it resonates with you. But watching it myself and being a part of making it with that ensemble and that group of characters, there is something about them that you just kind of want to keep hanging out with them. It's a weird sort of things they get up to and the way they deal with stuff and all of the dynamics that are going on between sort of a certain pairing here and a certain pairing here. And it's all kind of overlapping and crossing over. And they feel so real and human, and all the themes and emotions that they go through are just really relatable. So that I think you will take away from it that it's almost like you feel like you belong with them. So I think that's just a nice thing that people will enjoy getting involved in as they watch the series.
In terms of shooting the show, it seems like it's very much a sort of has two halves to it, because you've got you guys on the ship and then you've got a bunch of people back on Earth. Are you shooting in the same area? Is there much interaction between those two halves, or are you kind of completely separate?
Yeah, so we're on the same studio lot.
Okay.
But inevitably, because the Hemlock was, it's not like a lot of things where you've got rooms on the Hemlock shot in totally different lots. It was like it was built so that you could literally run a camera track around one spaceship. It's like I keep wanting to say, it is a real spaceship. It is not a real spaceship, as good as. So the old London set was on a different lot. Do I mean a different lot? Yeah, a different lot, but on the same. What do I mean? I don't know.
Different studio. So
we would see them in makeup, we'd see them in costume, but unfortunately, in a way, we didn't have very much crossover when we were actually acting. However, having said that, I think it was almost helpful. I think the extent to which it feels like a binary universe that they're in maybe was helped by the fact that I didn't really know what was happening, aside from reading it in the script. I didn't know what the atmosphere was. I didn't know what the culture of the old London set felt like. So when I came to watch it, it was so exciting because I felt like I was like I'd just never seen it before. It wasn't like I was watching it from behind the camera.
That's a good point. It was watching it. I realized that there's so much about that show that I'd had in my imagination, you know, with the Cold War stuff, which we didn't see so much of it with the special effects. So you can only just imagine what it's going to look like. So that when you watch it, I felt like a fan really watching it and just getting swept away in the whole new world, to quote Aladdin. It felt like it was, it just sort of really enticing, you know?
And the aesthetic was so different. I feel like they really successfully created these two worlds that like looked and felt different. The textures were different. Yeah. Again, Mark Garrity is just a genius, the way that he managed to create such diverging aesthetics, and yet it didn't feel like watching two different shows. Hmm. Don't know how I did it.
I thought your two characters had very interesting dynamics with the lead, Ash Harper. Oliver, you sort of come in with, you know, very masculine energy in a female-driven show. And then Verona also has a very interesting relationship with her. Can you talk about sort of how you developed that with Savannah and how that might evolve over the series?
I think for Echo, there's something about Ash Harper which he's just instantly drawn to. She's sort of fiery and feisty, and the first meeting they have is a fist fight, and she, you know, puts him on his ass. And it's sort of something about that is like, wow, I'm just drawn to it. I'm attracted to it, you know? And I think that's what really leads him to become involved in the Hemlock. That's why he kind of goes back there to sort of find her and see what it's about, and then becomes involved in the whole gang. And as it goes on, I think he becomes more and more involved with Ash, and he realizes there's feelings there that might be a little bit deeper than just sort of like a attraction or a challenge. And as it goes on, you know, he may develop some sort of relationship with her, but you know, you'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, and Verona and Ash have such a love-hate relationship throughout the series. I mean, they really just can't figure out what it is that they want from each other. I think having that initial meeting, her being arrested by Ash, it feels like a constant one-upmanship. They both want to have the high status all of the time. And I think it's really interesting in episode 3 when Verona is just forced to confront their prejudices about one another, like at every opportunity. So Verona, for the first time, witnesses firsthand Ash having enormous integrity. And she just can't square that with a Commonwealth cop. It doesn't make any sense to her. And again, I think this just happens every day in real life. I hope it's something that will resonate with audiences. And likewise, Verona is seeing someone who, to her mind, is a rebel and a criminal who deserves to be locked up. But on the other hand, she's witnessing somebody who's vulnerable and at times very kind and can't square it. So it's two people battling their prejudices constantly, is how I describe it.
My question is for Imogen and Oliver again. Something I've noticed during this junket is how tight all the cast seem to be. Like, you all seem to have like a really good rapport. You all seem to get on really well. Like, you've got nicknames for each other. So can you just talk?
Do we?
Yeah. I think Sharon Thomas Tomo at one point, I think.
Oh, yeah. Like,
oh, yeah. Oh, good point.
I thought it was going to be a lot worse than that. I was very curious.
Yeah, so it just seems like a really, really nice relationship. So can both of you just talk a bit about that?
It's okay.
I mean, obviously you can't get together physically, but have you bonded over Zoom or anything like that? Just, talk about your relationship.
It's not real. We're all very convincing actors. everyone just clicked. It's just a very lucky coincidence of personalities just really kind of understanding each other and just clicking, and also going towards an end goal and a common cause of let's make the show the best it can possibly be. And I've said it before, like days on the Hemlock where there's like 8 of us filming these scenes, and you're on there for a long time and it can get quite cramped because there's like lots of crew. But I just loved it. Everyone was, you know, having a joke and laughing around and really sort of kind and generous with their ideas and stuff. And it just felt like as soon as they said action, it was professionalism and we'll get this done. Let's make it the best it can be. And we've got these ideas and what about this and what about this? And then when we were offset, we just kind of relaxed into each other's company. It was a real luxury, don't you think, Amy?
Yeah. And it's testament to Carmel Cochrane who cast this thing, because it's a mammoth task and she just nailed the chemistry. I think most of us had chemistry tests with other people, and I just think she just completely nailed it. She managed to get an incredibly diverse group of people, and we're all really different. This is the thing that kept astonishing me. When we'd all find each other, we were going out, we were all in Manchester for the shoot, and we'd be going out, and we're like, we are 8 very different people who got on like a house on fire. I don't know how she managed it, but she did. And it was just a joy every single day. And we've been mainly online, but we did sneak in a couple of drinks, didn't we?
Yeah,
we're lockdown-y. We managed it last year.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's not too long before we can all meet up closer to release and properly raise a glass.
Assuming, as I'm sure it will does the show does really well and you get another season, it's a sort of very British cast. If you could get one big British actor to come in and guest star on it, who would you like to bring in?
Ooh, good question.
That's a great question. Who do you think it means?
Do you know I just don't want to get anyone that I'm worried is just going to be a lot better than me.
Yeah. Do you know who I love? George Mackay. That's who I'd want to get in it. I love George Mackay.
Good shout.
I think he's an amazing actor and he's a lovely boy. And let's get him in there. He'll slot into that gang perfect.
Yeah, that's good. It's a cliche, but I am going to go with Dame Judi Dench. I don't know where she'd fit into the narrative and I'm struggling to place that. But I have every faith in Judy Geary. I just think that would be completely wonderful. Maybe she could just be like on a throne at the back of the Hemlock.
Yeah.
That's what I'd like.
That's a great answer. Jealous of that answer. Well done.
So those were the interviews with the cast and crew of Intergalactic. I urge you to go and watch it. It's released on Friday, the 30th of April on Sky One and Now TV, and all episodes will be available on demand from that date as well. Of course, if you want to hear more behind the scenes interviews, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast by searching for Geektown Radio. This will also give you our weekly Geektown Radio podcast, which brings you all the latest TV, filming and gaming news. You can also go to the website at geektown.co.uk UK for daily news stories and all the latest UK and US TV premiere dates.